Hello and welcome to episode 10 of the What's Up podcast, recorded on the 7th of December 2016. Today's panel is myself, Martin Black.
I'm Alistair Bruce.
And I'm William Taylor.
So it's been a fairly short period since we recorded our last podcast. So rather than talking about up-to-date news stories, because there actually hasn't been a whole lot since we last recorded, we're going to talk about some slightly older stories and some interesting stuff that's happened sort of in the field of space science in the last week or so. So we're going to talk about Margaret Hamilton.
Yes.
We're going to talk about the ESA project review that happened this week, and also today's Google Doodle. So Ali, tell us about Margaret Hamilton.
She very recently was just awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by Obama himself, which is very cool. And she was awarded this medal because she is the lady who was in charge of the team at MIT to create the software that would run on the moon program's computers. So the Apollo program, so the command module and the lunar module, they needed computers to run things. This was way back when computers were barely getting to the sort of modern computers that we have today. And Margaret Hamilton and her team were tasked with writing the software that would make these fairly clunky bits of kit work seamlessly together. And
is this computer on board?
Yes. Yeah. So this is the Apollo guidance computer. And it had two components. So one was the display panel that you see in Apollo 13. And that was the one that astronauts, it was called the disky panel. So you had a bunch of displays that were like, I'm having a problem, or everything's green. And you had some numbers and you could type in numbers and it would rotate the spacecraft for you. And the guidance platform was folded into that. And most of the time, NASA were in control from Houston, I believe. But if NASA's connection suddenly disappeared, or if the moon got in the way, which it tended to do on the missions, this computer would take over. And it was pretty good by modern standards. So she only gets credited with the sort of being the original software engineer. And there's a very famous picture of her back when they'd written literally a stack of code to go into this little computer with 64 kilobytes of RAM or something. It was so tiny. You often hear the modern thing about calculators being better than that, and that's still true. I think they are better in terms of memory and speed. But she's standing beside her stack, which is the printout for this entire bit of code. But the reason she's getting the medal isn't just because that's quite cool. It's because she's probably the reason the moon landings were successful, especially on Apollo 11, because they were getting error messages that potentially could have crashed a less well-designed system on the computer. So there was a problem. You had the service module and the command module were in orbit around the moon. The lunar module was detached and obviously on its way down to the surface. And the computer in the lunar module was getting overloaded with data. And there was stuff coming from the radar for rendezvous, and there was stuff coming from the ground radar, and there was stuff to do with just monitoring the interior, and it was throwing up alarms. And the computer was the software was designed in a clever way by Margaret Hamilton and her guys to make it as redundant as possible. So this computer was smart enough to know, right, I don't have enough time to compute everything I need to compute. I'm going to throw away the things that are a smaller priority. And in this case, that was getting rid of the rendezvous radar, which it turns out wasn't needed anyway. And they made it to the moon. But potentially that could have crashed the computer and, you might have had a bigger issue. So
a slightly different story then.
So yeah, so it's Neil and Buzz and Mike and Margaret and her team. So it helped make the landing work.
So the risk of getting into politics, possibly, why is she only just getting this award, or is it?
Why is she only getting it now?
I mean, after all this time.
Well, it's a fine question. I don't really know.
Is this a gender issue that she's just been flatly ignored?
I hope not. I mean, she does get used an awful lot as a sort of a nice example of a very prominent female figure in one, you could argue was not a great time for gender equality in American history. So, it's interesting. But I quite like that you're still getting recognized for that kind of thing, because it was she is kind of like the pioneer of modern software.
I think there's probably some degree of politics involved, because the presidential medals, I think, are pretty much at the president's discretion. It's up to them to hand them out.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think this is a positive point for President Obama, that he's picking people who maybe should have got credit some time ago and haven't. And he's making a point of using his medals for that purpose.
Maybe even deliberately politically.
Instead of complaining in tweets, which seems to be the done thing these days. Very presidential.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, perhaps you don't care if you get a presidential medal. It doesn't matter when you get it, even if it's 50 years after your work was done. But maybe perhaps you do care when you get it because you want it now rather than 6 months' time.
But anyway, yeah, that's true. I mean, to be honest, I think for her, as far as her colleagues were concerned, they all knew that the one of the key components of the whole moon program was thanks based to her and her team.
Yeah.
But there's lots of good examples like that in NASA. So you could, for every Margaret Hamilton, there probably are a few more that aren't known. And, you know, you talked about that movie that's coming out quite soon about some of the mathematicians that were in the background that nobody had known about and were kind of, you know, history has almost forgotten. So it's going to be nice to sort of revisit those kind of things too and sort of make sure everyone gets their credit and not just the astronauts.
Well, those missions were so phenomenally complex. There must have been so many systems and aspects of it which were in their small way utterly essential. That's clearly quite a big thing, a nav system like that. But there must be so many people who actually made decisions which, had they done something slightly differently, might have been a very different result.
I was reading up on a phrase in Apollo 13, the one of NASA's highest level of praise. You get called a steely-eyed missile man. And it's a nice thing to say. Obviously, it's gender-based, so it's not so appropriate these days. But back then, that was one of their highest levels of praise. And that was, if you were a person who literally saved a mission, that was the title you got. So there was a guy on Apollo 12, which got struck by lightning on launch, which knocked out the guidance computer and everything was going wiggy in the cockpit. And a little person in mission control called Aaron something, I can't remember his name, he knew to flick a certain switch. So if you've ever seen, there's a meme, try SCE to AUX, and that's the name of the switch that saved Apollo 12. So he radioed up to flick this switch. Al Bean was like, I've never flicked this switch before, but I knew where it was. So he flicked it and the backup guidance came back online and the mission was saved. But so he got that title, and Apollo 13 use it for one of the guys that makes a air filter for the carbon dioxide scrubber thing. Oh, lots of cool little bits of history like that. Like,
they don't get presidential medals though, do they? Sadly. Which would you prefer?
I'd settle for being a steely-eyed missile man. Anything, you know.
If you could choose, steely-eyed missile man, presidential medal,
missile man,
missile man, definitely.
Yeah, probably. I mean,
the odds of Trump giving me anything, you know,
slim.
Yeah, I should probably not talk about Trump. You know,
no. So you're talking about all these sort of redundancies are built into the systems to prevent system failures. Mm. Something else has happened recently that, you know, a team might have benefited from a similar system. So we're going to segue from that topic onto the ESA review and particularly into mentioning something about ExoMars.
Yeah, poor, well, pre-ExoMars. Actually, I'm not entirely sure. I don't understand the
name. I think all counts as part of the ExoMars mission.
Yeah, so Schiaparelli, which sadly has died. And landed in a bump on the surface.
Bump.
Quite a big bump.
Yeah. A new crater on Mars.
A new blackened crater on Mars.
Very expensive crater.
But the interesting thing is that they were releasing data about exactly what happened and what went wrong. And it seems to be something that the system which is monitoring the rotation basically flaked out and it received. It's registered too high a rotation, and that somehow flagged up that the for the altitude system that it actually, and I don't understand how this is even possible, but the altitude system seemed to suggest that it was at negative altitude, as in below ground,
because
and that
spinning.
Made it all go, oh, crikey, we should, because this was the parachute had been deployed successfully, mm-hmm. and there was too much motion, which basically put it, you know, beyond safety measures.
It's like the Die Hard 2 thing, you know, ground level set too low, your thing isn't going to come in a happy way.
It does seem a bit odd that I can understand that it might say somehow it gets the measurement wrong, but surely there should have been a line in the code which went, if number is below zero, ignore.
You said it when it was rotating. Well, did it specify what axis it's rotating on?
No, I didn't say enough about that, and I haven't looked enough. I don't know.
Rather than rotating, it was tumbling.
That's possible.
Then maybe you would get a negative altitude.
I don't know if you can tumble if you're.
So can I just check? It is meant to rotate, isn't it? Because it's a rotation stabilized thing.
Stabilize, yeah.
But if it's rotating on the axis of the parachute, I can see how that would help. Mm-hmm. Like rifling a bullet.
And is this just accelerometers, or are we talking like gyroscopes?
I think accelerometers.
Okay.
But basically, whatever happened made it think that it was at a different altitude, which is why it then shut off it disconnected from the parachute, it turned on its thrusters to land, mm-hmm. and actually it got to the point where the system thought it had landed,
yeah,
and kicked in and said, I'm on the surface, and started its on-surface activities. Unfortunately, the poor thing was still hurtling down about 2 miles above the surface at this point when it thought it had arrived.
It's a shame because, yeah, software things are so easy. You can even send a patch when it's traveling and stuff. So it's just
I can't help but think of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the whale that's falling. And you're just talking to itself and being quite happy. And, I'm going to open up now and start doing my experiments. And then suddenly flap into the ground.
But intriguingly, the fact that it's gone wrong in this way means that they've seen that all the sequences work.
Mm-hmm.
If it sort of just hit too soon and it was still in landing mode, whereas it actually did everything correctly except for one step, which it didn't do enough, which was the parachute. So
it's not the whale, it's the bola petunias, because its last thought was, oh no, not again, which is kind of where I am. I'm just going, oh really?
Yeah.
I thought we'd got past crashing on Mars.
Yeah, so which is unfortunate. So this leads on to discussing what's happened more recently with ExoMars, the mission, is that they have agreed. There was a large meeting recently for ESA to discuss their future priorities and discuss everything they do with their quite significant budget, actually. We're talking billions of pounds over the next, I think it was over the next decade they're sort of reviewing, but still.
Just for reference sake, I think ESA's budget, last I heard, this was a few years ago now, but last I heard, ESA's budget equates to 50 pence per person per year in Europe.
Okay, give it to the NHS. So they had this review and they've agreed to fund the lander part of ExoMars, which is going off in a couple of years' time. 4 years' time. And this will
this is flagship funding.
This is big money. Yeah. This is a lot of money, and I think this is ESA saying, no, we're not backing down from the challenge. Yes, we've tried to land on Mars twice and crashed twice. But we reckon we've learned enough. And ironically, in some ways, the fact that everything worked quite well is quite good. Well, Beagle 2 kind of crashed.
Beagle landed.
Okay, no, that's true.
It landed fine. It had a dodgy hit.
It had two surface failures.
Yes.
Yes. See how you have these meetings where you've got to say
politics.
spot the engineer.
Yeah. So they've had two less successful missions, but they're not going to be put off, and they're going to do it, and they're going to land, which I think is all very cool and very interesting. The thing which I thought was particularly intriguing about this, though, and has upset some people, is the fact that I don't know if it's entirely because of overruns and cost increases for ExoMars, but they have had to cancel or at least put on the back burner another mission, which is the AIM mission, which has upset a lot of people because it's quite a cool mission. And I should be caveating this that some of the people are being a bit ranty about things I was reading were sort of like, well, they're funding ExoMars, therefore they're not funding AIM. I'm not sure it's quite that simple. It might be for other reasons as well, to be fair. But the AIM mission was cool. I think it's in some ways sounded a bit more interesting. So this was an idea that there's a binary pair of asteroids, which are one is about 800 meters in diameter, 150 meters in diameter.
So a binary pair means they're traveling each other's orbit, each other's mass.
So basically, the little one is basically a moon of the bigger one,
but on a much smaller scale.
Yeah, and it's coming relatively close to, it's like 11 million kilometers from the Earth or something at some point.
Still pretty far.
But this is sufficiently close that you can get good measurements of their position. So NASA have proposed a mission where they're going to basically fire something at it and try and deflect the smaller moon.
Is the thing they're firing Bruce Willis?
I don't know.
No.
Hopefully.
Sorry, carry on. I'll just keep humming the tune. Yeah.
That's appalling. So they will fire this thing at it, and they were going to try and measure using telescopes on the ground whether they've deflected an asteroid, which of course is pretty exciting because if you can actually, even if it's a tiny deflection, it's kind of a vague proof of concept of defense against asteroids.
The 5-year-old in me wants this to be some giant nuke, but I have a feeling it's just going to be a solid
mass. Just a solid
mass. Yeah,
The thing isn't huge, but you fire something like the size of a washing machine at it at very, very high speed, and it just nudges it. And that's maybe all you need if you have time.
I still wonder why in space science generally a washing machine is a standard unit of measurement.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. It's about a washing machine sized.
Because I was speaking to satellites, and a small sat is about the size of a washing machine, and a micro sat's about a microwave. It's like, really? Is this how you measure these things?
Domestic appliances. anyway, so that is happening. So, hopefully gonna happen. NASA are planning something. It's called DART, which is quite a good name. Fine, right? But what ESA had been planning to do was to launch a different mission, which would get to this binary system in advance and would take lots of imagery of it. It would also, apparently, this system had two deployable CubeSats, which are like mini CubeSats, maybe the size of a toaster, say.
Well, yeah, CubeSats are 10 centimeter cubes.
Yes.
And you usually get a 3U, which is 30 centimeters by 10 by 10.
Okay, so Rubik's cubes. Yeah, three Rubik's cubes stuck together almost. It's pretty small. Anyway, they're going to deploy two of those and apparently a lander of some kind. So this was quite ambitious. But it meant that they would have this wonderful imaging system with these, well, two CubeSats and the larger mothership. I like using that word, mothership. It's, we have space missions with motherships. That's quite cool. Yeah. Anyway, so that, those would be there imaging it, and then the dart would come flying in, smack into it, and they'd get lots of measurements of what gets thrown up and yada, yada. It would be a really exciting mission and really genuinely different.
I'm guessing the key point here with two CubeSats is you have one, like you have basically stereo imaging. You've got 3D imaging, which is,
you could really far more work out orientations, etc. But sadly, that's the bit that's been cut. So the dart will still hit it, and we'll have to measure it from the Earth rather than having close up imagery.
That's a shame. We've smacked into a comet before, so that was NASA, wasn't it?
We've done that a couple of times.
And but with nothing close. I think that had two stage, or something was fired out, and something was
the thing
following.
Also, they don't even have a following.
I don't know.
Thing.
Maybe they do. Perhaps I didn't see anything when I was reading about that.
I think it's fairly easy to do because you just spit out your mass a little bit early and then you break a little bit and then you can see the mess that you make. Mm-hmm. So we should still get some nice movies, I guess, of this.
Maybe. I'm not entirely sure. Mm. Or whether they were relying on ESA doing the imagery.
I can just see the meeting now, though, which is like, so wait, the Americans are doing this thing, they're sending a probe, and you want us to go to the same place and see the same event with a flagship mission. Yeah. So
a lander and two CubeSats and a mothership. That's, that's four separate things.
Well, yeah, although actually this wasn't a huge mission. It was, I think in terms of the cost of a lander, it was much more than that. And this was on a very quick timescale. This passes in 2022.
All right.
So I don't think it was massively complex. And the other thing they were talking about was the fact they were hoping to try and test using the CubeSats. They were trying to test some optical communication system in space, which has never been tried before. So they're trying to bootstrap other things. Maybe this is an example of like overkill. They're trying to do too much. Yeah. So perhaps there are really good reasons why it's been jettisoned, not the Mars thing.
Is this the laser-based communication? Because I was hearing about, I think we've now got communication satellites that have started using this. So this is like a satellite that's designed to talk to other satellites. Yeah. And I know nothing about it other than the press article that I read. Mm-hmm. So we can maybe talk about that another time. But it was sounding quite interesting because it's like a broadband for satellites. Because you can't always see your ground station if you're in a low orbit. So you can bounce it off something that's designed to have a really high speed transfer rate, which is kind of cool.
You do get laser communications for satellites, and it does help, but it's difficult. And my concern with... So, putting on the project manager hat and my limited knowledge of CubeSat technologies, those CubeSats that you're suggesting are pretty complicated. Imaging systems on CubeSats are difficult because of the size. Mm. Pointing accuracy is awkward, to say the least. Laser communication systems in a CubeSat, you can barely do it on a mini-sat or a micro-sat CubeSat. Oh, you're really trying to push it now. Trying to put all that into one proposal, you've got 10 years of technology demonstration before you even start thinking.
I'm not going to lie, because it does sound, when you say lander on Mars or big, crazy, complicated thing that's going to hang around a binary asteroid pair and see the mess that NASA's going to make of it, that does sound quite cool.
Yeah, it sounds... Starting this conversation by discussing the two things which have, what did you say? Not deployed, no, not surface success.
Limited surface, surface failures, I think.
Right, surface failures. So despite the previous two surface failures, you can't, I've lost my thread, what was I saying? It feels like this was more exciting. You feel like landing on Mars is something which, okay, ESA haven't done it, but it has been done. Mm. I'm not saying, clearly it's going to do cool things. ExoMars is drilling below the surface, which nobody's done before, like 2 meters down. That's pretty damn cool. Mm. But this sounds really ambitious, really exciting. I think it sounds more akin to kind of Rosetta and the general excitement which came with that.
You do realize we won't know until it either works or doesn't that we'll be like, oh, should have gone to the asteroid.
Yeah. But having said that, I'm not sure this is a fair discussion in that they have funded one thing and they've cancelled something else. Whether the two are connected, I don't know. Yeah. It's a clearly, I think the sizes of money are not dissimilar, so it's clearly people have gone, oh, look, they've chosen that over that.
Given that they've already put half of the hardware for the ExoMars in orbit around Mars as well, that's they've already gone down that
that's
path
very
a lot.
And they've spent a lot on development already. I mean, ExoMars have been around for a long time. They weren't going to cancel ExoMars.
Yeah.
Just don't.
I'm just glad it's still going ahead, to be honest.
Yeah, well, that's a great thing.
Well, with the failed Schiaparelli thing, you would worry that somebody might go, are you sure you could do this?
Yeah. But if you could choose, if you were sitting here now and they said, here's $500 million or something like that, which I think are the sort of numbers we're talking, which way would you put it? Lander on Mars?
Cool. I feel bad, but asteroid.
Yeah.
Well,
I think it's interesting.
From a benefit to humanity.
I wasn't even thinking that side.
There's potentially more use in knowing how to do this sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Although, you know, Elon Musk, he's going to go to Mars and it'll be fine.
He'll just pick him up on the way. He'll just grab some asteroids.
The thing is, I'd probably say Mars lander. I think you're right in that for humanity's sake, it's better to go for the asteroid thing, and that is more exciting as well and probably more scientifically interesting. However,
think of all the Bruce Willis memes that we'll get over the next few years. It'll be great.
But if I was funding this, one of those is much higher risk than the other because there's not the technology there. I think you still want to do the asteroid thing, but I would need a lot of proof to show me that there's a lot of technologies there that haven't been developed. So if I was a funding agency, I'd be putting more money into ExoMars and saying, okay, here's small amounts of money to go and develop various different technologies you need to do this other mission. But you need to put that
I mean, maybe ambition and technical readiness has come into the decision. I don't know. But if you could choose, I think I'd vote with Ali. So if we were in charge, it'd be 2-1.
Straight to the roids. Yes. let's do it.
If you want, I can get the ESA manual on technology readiness levels for space missions and show you why you can't have CubeSats.
Well, now we said this, I don't know enough about the mission to know whether we can slate its technology. I assume it had been through reviews previously. And
when JFK announced the moon landings, they didn't know how to do nothing. It was like using things that have not yet been invented. Like, that was actually said in his speech. And you're kind of like, fair play, because I can't see anybody currently.
What did he say?
We've not invented the thing I'm going to do in the next 10 years, but trust us, we'll get there. And yeah, that's difficult.
What was his wonderful line recently, something about we're going to do this and the other stuff?
We choose to go to the moon and to do the other things, not because they're easy, but because they're hard.
The other things, on the most. Anyway, this was another thing, and it wasn't done, which I think is a little bit sad.
Domestic foreign policy, the other things. World peace, yes, but we've got to beat the Russians first, and then we can.
Yeah.
Okay, we can talk about the Russian moon program another time.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a cool moon program.
Lots of cool things going on.
Rover galore. one last thing we should probably talk about, which was today's Google Doodle. So those of you that use Google will know that sometimes I do these little cartoons that tell you an interesting fact about the day. When this morning's one came up, I looked at it and went, huh? And I actually had to click into it because I had no idea what it was on about. But apparently it's something quite important.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to lie. I didn't recognize the guy's name, did you?
No. I mean, it's quite important, but in the sense of it's still a random, like 340th anniversary or something. I find it weird the way they pick. You know, it's not like the 100th, the 200th. They do it on the, you know, the 42nd.
But it's a sciencey one.
Oh, no, it's good.
You don't
always
see a sciencey Google deal. But it's. I'm not going to pronounce the name right. I'm not going to lie. I did just have to look up the name again because I can't remember it. Ole Romer, with a strike through it. So Danish astronomer.
It means diameter, doesn't it, on technical drawings?
Oh, does it? So he is roundly credited with being the first person to have a credible measurement for the speed of light. And what is probably cooler is that he did it using Jupiter's moons, which is almost more fun than doing something where you're bouncing off mirrors in a lab or whatever. He actually used the solar system to do it, and that was kind of cool. It's a bit involved. How much detail do you want? How much time do we have?
We've got a few minutes. Can you give us the Cliff Notes version?
Okay.
It's
basically the Io, the closest in moon, buzzes around Jupiter like a firefly. It's something like every 40-something hours it completes one circuit.
Yeah, if you get the chance to observe Jupiter through a telescope, maybe even through binoculars, and you can see Io. If you watch it over consecutive nights, you will see Io move at quite a... quite noticeably over the course of a couple of nights.
Yes.
That's a full orbit, two nights.
If you keep your eye on Io, there's quite a cool event that will happen at some point in the orbit, and that is the moment where Io disappears into Jupiter's shadow. So not necessarily being eclipsed by the planet itself, just the fact that the sun is in a different position relative to the Earth, so the shadow projects out behind Jupiter, and every so often Io just winks out of existence, as do the other moons as well. But Io, it happens more regularly, so you can time exactly when this happens. And that was a big deal back then because they couldn't make accurate clocks. So we're talking, you know, late 1600s, ships needed better clocks. So they were even talking about using Io as like kind of like a cosmic clock for sailors. Bit hard to use binoculars and telescopes on boats, but there you go. So anyway, you've got the disappearing of Io, and the reappearing can also be measured really precisely from Earth. And it turns out that you have to be quite clever. You have to know Kepler's third law and to work out where the Earth is, where Jupiter is, how often Io goes around it. You know that the orbits both aren't circular, Io relative to Jupiter and the Earth relative to the Sun, but they're close, but you can correct for those two things. And you can predict when the Io is going to disappear or reappear. And that's the useful bit, because if you can predict when it's going to happen, somebody without a clock can see it happen and know exactly where they are on the planet or what time it is, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it turns out there's a third thing that you need to correct for, and this is where Ole comes in. And it's noticing that when the Earth is moving towards Jupiter in its orbit, the eclipses events happen with a shorter distance between them in time. And as we're moving away from Jupiter, the eclipses fall a little bit further behind. And the delay is caused by the fact that in the time it takes Io to do 42 hours round, the Earth has moved 42 hours worth away from Jupiter in its orbit at 30 kilometers a second, whatever we're doing. I don't know what the relative speeds are. But it affects the timing because the light takes that little bit longer to reach the Earth by about a few minutes. And he was able to sit down and work out that the times were delayed. And you can work out. So the few minutes thing.
You're looking skeptical.
Minutes?
To be honest, because the number that gets quoted is a few minutes, but it depends which event you're comparing to which. So you can have a list of predicted events, but okay. I would need to work out exactly.
Well, Earth Sun is 8 minutes.
Yeah, and we're talking about a fraction of the orbit.
Yeah.
So the difference between the two.
Sorry, the 3 minutes I'll be quoting is the difference that you get compared to what the average is. So it can be plus or minus 3 minutes because of the effect of the Earth going around. So when we're on the far side of the Sun. But you can't do this when Jupiter's too close to the Sun either. So you have to wait till Jupiter's a bit further around. And so the 3 minutes will be that value.
Well, in what? Jupiter must be a 2 AU out?
No, it's like 5.
5 AU. Okay, yeah, so that's...
Yeah.
40 minutes travel time for the
sense?
Sun. Yeah, okay. Yeah. You know,
I'm not going to lie. I had to check all this and work out the
bit of logic.
Yeah.
But he did it really well, didn't he? He got within sort of
20% or something. Yeah. But given that they couldn't even make good clocks back then that could go on ships, that is a kind of a huge
It wasn't
feat.
Even known that this that light had a finite speed. People theorized it, but no. Apparently, I read something saying Galileo had tried to measure it by doing like things with lamps on different hills and stuff.
Yeah.
But the scales were too small to see any discernible difference. You need a solar system as your laboratory.
Yeah.
But I love the fact that he'd tried. He's like, oh, well, if the speed of light within this, then if I turn that light on there and
measure
it. Yeah,
I seem to recall this like two shutters, and as soon as the person on the other hill opens it, you know, you open the shutter, that person opens the shutter as soon as they see it, and you time the time it takes to see that.
Mm.
And it got something really low. But that's just reaction speeds.
Yeah.
Because people are not very fast.
No, not at the speed of light.
Yeah, my school, we couldn't even measure the speed of sound accurately. Like hit the stopwatch and just, measurement errors all the way.
Yeah.
So the fact that somebody 300 years ago went, it's this driven 20%,
Yeah, and the doodle is quite nice. It's a wee cartoony. He drew a diagram that wasn't to scale, hence the issues. It's probably not 3 minutes for a single eclipse variation. It'll be seconds or something, but that's why you need to be so accurate with your timing.
Yeah.
So land-based clock. Became the thing. So in the end, I don't think they ended up using Io for celestial navigation. It was just too complicated to have optics that could see it.
Yeah, when did Harrison do his clock? Because that was the...
And once you've got a good clock, you don't need it.
Yeah.
It was probably around the same sort of time that he...
Mm-hmm.
When was it?
Yeah. I don't even know how to use a sextant. Anyone else used one before? I'm aware of them.
I know the theory.
Yeah, point out a star, measure exactly where it is, and then measure the time exactly, and you can work out where you are on the planet, which is kind of cool.
It's amazing, really.
I like that.
Beautifully simple,
yeah.
If you know the time. But
yes,
the fact that that's really hard to do is actually something which seems so odd to us now, because we have clocks and phones and everything. There's times everywhere. We're constantly with us, and the idea that people didn't have a foggiest.
An interesting local fact for any listeners in Edinburgh. The Royal Observatory was previously responsible for keeping clocks in Edinburgh. This is back when we were on Carlton Hill rather than on Blackpool as we are now. The 1 o'clock gun was previously fired with an electric cable that ran from Carlton Hill to the castle at exactly 1 o'clock would be fired, and it was synchronised with the time ball on top of the What's the monument on that hill?
Does it have a specific
Nelson's?
Name?
Nelson's, yes, it's Nelson's. Nelson's Tower. Monument, Nelson's Tower. That ball dropped to the bottom of its travel at exactly 1 o'clock as well, so that ships that were further out could base their clocks on that rather than the sound of the cannon, because the speed of sound would mean you were late.
Apparently there are maps, so if you know where you are in the Firth of Forth, the map told you exactly how much delay you had
add,
so that when you hear the gun, it's lovely. So I think they're around that you can get a copy of somewhere. Pretty cool.
Measurement of time and clocks are really an interesting topic in itself. Yeah. That is a cool topic.
Yeah. What's your job? I control time.
Sadly, we no longer control time here.
No.
But we are out of time now. Physics. So,
Very good.
Thank you. I think we'll call it there.
Maybe we should say Happy Christmas. Ali has been done this entire podcast with a Santa hat on.
I was debating whether or not to mention it, but I hope it should have been feel mentioned. The Christmas cheer through the earpiece.
Did listeners hear and realise, I wonder?
The inherent Christmas cheer.
Yeah.
Okay, well, have a good season, and thank you very much.
Cheers, all.
Bye.